box to their custody. As we spoke, they were examining it at the station. Something about all this was naggingly familiar, but I couldn't put a finger on what. "When did this happen?" Holmes demanded, hands shaking. I hadn't realized that she'd cared about Lena so much. "Just now. I spoke with her not 20 minutes ago." The detective took out a notepad and paper.
"What about?"
Holmes's mouth twitched. "She'd spilled punch on me at homecoming and wanted to know if I was still angry. I told her I was over it and we'd get my dress to the cleaners. No harm, no foul." So it had been Lena on the phone earlier. I'd never seen Holmes take one of her roommate's calls before. She always sent them and everyone else's straight to voicemail to screen at her leisure.
"Does she know that you went down to the station? Did she know where you were today?" he asked.
"No," she said. "The only person I really talked to is Jamie. I doubt anyone at the school knows I'm gone unless they saw you haul us away in the cruiser, but it was dark." My father was taking notes in a chair in the corner. "Dark," he muttered to himself. "But Lena's okay?" Holmes asked. Her lower lip trembled. "I'm sorry, I just... This sounds awful, but I really do think that man was there to hurt me, not Lena. And that weird box. Jamie, doesn't it ring a bell for you too?" She wasn't acting like herself. She was acting normal. Like she'd have any reaction other than swift and extreme mobilization at hearing that she'd missed a crime in her own dorm room. Like she wasn't... I put it together in a flash. Oh, she was brilliant. Like a hurtling comet you couldn't look at dead on without burning your retinas right off. Like a bioluminescent lake. She was a 16-year-old detective savant who could tell your life story from a look, who retrofitted little carved boxes with surprise poison springs early on a Saturday morning when everyone else, including me, was asleep in their beds. She'd set herself up to be the target of a fake crime to get us off the hook for the real one, and she'd used Lena and some mysterious guy to do it. "Culverton Smith," I said, piecing it together aloud for Shepard's sake. "It's from a home story. We're being set up. Jesus Christ, tell your policeman to wear gloves when handling that box. Thick ones." To his credit, he took me seriously.
"Making a call, but I want an explanation as soon as I'm back."
He stepped outside. "You," I said to her, "are a genius." Across the table, Holmes slipped from false concern into very real satisfaction. "It's quite a good story, you know, the adventure of the dying detective. Pity that Dr. Watson smothered what should have been an exercise in logic in all that sentimental garbage about his partner. The adventure of the dying detective, for me, has always been the hardest of the Sherlock Holmes stories to read, and not because it isn't brilliantly done. It's 1890. Dr. Watson, who's living with his wife away from Baker Street, is urgently called to Sherlock Holmes's bedside. The detective has caught a rare, highly contagious disease that, as he tells Dr. Watson, can only be cured by Culverton Smith, a specialist in tropical illnesses living nearby. The catch? Smith hates Holmes because he correctly accused Smith of murder. His victim was infected with and died of this same disease. But Holmes insists that Watson bring Smith anyway, that Smith is their only hope. While Holmes rattles off a series of ridiculous-sounding orders on how Watson is to go about fetching the specialist, Watson idly picks up a small ivory box that's been resting on the table. Out of nowhere, Holmes insists that Watson put it down and not touch it again. All the while, Watson thinks his best friend is dying. It's wrenching to read, and even more so as we watch Watson follow Holmes's orders, the clear product of a hallucinating mind, to the letter. From trust or affection or old habit, we're not sure, but either way, the last of these insane directions has Watson hiding himself in the closet in preparation for Smith's arrival. Smith comes in. The gaslight is low. Holmes is sweating in feverish agony on the settee. The specialist begins to gloat, thinking he and the detective are alone. That little ivory box? He'd mailed it, fitted with an infected metal spring, hoping to catch Holmes with it unaware. After Smith has confessed everything to Holmes, who he believes to be a dead man, Holmes asks him to turn up the gaslight. It's a signal. In bursts Inspector Morton of Scotland Yard, who's been waiting at the door, and Watson, who's witnessed the whole conversation from the closet. Smith is hauled away to jail. And Holmes, not sick at all. He faked his symptoms, starved himself for 3 days until he was skin and bone, then applied a convincing coat of stage makeup to make himself appear at death's door. As for the box, well, he wasn't in any danger. He reminds Watson that he always thoroughly examines his mail. Charlotte Holmes had stripped the dying detective for details and rearranged them to make her own narrative, pulling Lena in on her scheme to sell the story. I wondered who the man in the ski mask was. Tom? Unlikely. Still, it was just the sort of story that our Sherlock-obsessed murderer would have seized on and used against us. The part I couldn't get over, that distracted me from even this show of Charlotte Holmes's powers, was remembering how much my great-great-great-grandfather had trusted hers. Oysters, I remembered. Between the instructions he'd given Dr. Watson, Sherlock Holmes had been ranting in his hallucinations about oysters, and his partner had still followed his directions exactly. I thought about the piped-in interrogation in the police station, about the little notebook that still lay open between us on the table, about how my own doubts about Holmes's innocence ran alongside my doubt that she could get us out of this mess. She had just gotten us out of this mess, and no matter what my head wanted to tell me, I knew in my bones that she wasn't a killer. "I'm sorry I didn't trust you," I said to my Holmes in a low voice. She shook her head. "I needed your shock to be genuine for me to sell it. I don't mean about the details. I don't need to hear the details." I reached across the table to put my hand on hers. "I meant to say that I won't doubt you again." I watched her catalog me, the planes of my face, the tilt of my head, how I sat in my chair, my fingers heat and the ruck of my hair. She took it all in, deduced from what she saw, and came up in the end with something she hadn't expected. "You won't," she said with flat surprise. "You really won't, will you?" Next to me, my father cleared his throat. I didn't spare him a glance. When Shepard returned from speaking to his team, we gave him the background on the Culverton-Smith story, and he told us what we already knew. They had, in fact, found a spring loaded into the ivory box, poised to strike when it was slid open. That spring was coated in an infectious tropical disease. The police lab weren't sure of its exact origin, but they guessed it to be Asia. Samples of this kind were tightly controlled, and so far their search into local scientists who had requested access to them had ended in an absolute null. I asked Holmes, much later, how she got her hands on the sample. She said something about Milo, an ex-girlfriend at the CDC, and catching as catch can.
"This blows my list of suspects wide open," Shepard said. "So we're back to option one. Someone trying their damnedest to frame you two. We'll need to talk about who out there in the world wants to get you, and I'll have to notify the station that I won't be needing a pair of cells. At least, not tonight."
So his plan had been to arrest us. "Let us help you," Holmes said. "I'm an official informant for Scotland Yard, and between Watson and me..." I was gratified to be back on a last-name basis. "We're experts on the killer's M.O., Sherlock Holmes stories, with the obvious choice, not to mention that we can informally question anyone at Sherringford without arousing suspicion, or that you're getting an excellent chemist and a relatively fearless pugilist in the bargain. We're not a bargain. We're luxury goods."
"No," he said. "Absolutely not."
Holmes shrugged. She'd anticipated this response. "Then I'll conduct my own investigation and deal with the culprit after I catch him or her as I see fit."
"You actually think that threatening vigilante justice will make me want to take you two on?" Shepard demanded. "You're a child. I don't know how desperate the police are across the pond, but we play it by the book here. Isn't it enough that you're not suspects anymore? I don't see any reason to put you and Jamie in the line of fire.
Really? Then perhaps call Scotland Yard again and ask them about what transpired after I sat through this exact conversation with D.I. Green. If she's reluctant to speak to you, tell her you know all about the deep freezer, the meat hook, and how I found her 2 minutes before the killer returned. Honestly, I might have gotten myself there sooner if she hadn't been such a cow about it. Just the year before, I'd recovered £3 million worth of jewels and given her all the credit. She yawned. Do it in the morning, though. I'm knackered.
But...
Mr. Watson, this was a lovely dinner. Would you mind taking us home now?
Without waiting for a response, Holmes disappeared into the garage, her gown trailing after her. In her flair for the dramatic, she'd left behind my jacket and her phone. I collected them, trying not to feel like her valet.
That girl was a piece of work, Shepherd said, somewhere between admiration and despair. Holmes is, my father laughed and reached for his car keys. Would you know she's one of the nicer ones?
7. It took Shepherd less than a day to agree to Holmes's terms.
You have until Thanksgiving break, he said to us.
I had him on speakerphone. He'd spent all that morning sleuthing in Holmes's and Lena's room and come up empty-handed. I wasn't surprised. Holmes, of course, had been thorough.
That's a little less than a month. We'll share information. Share it. Do you understand me? D.I. Green warned me about how you like to play the magician so you can do the big reveal at the end. That won't fly here. A long, scratchy pause. The only reason I'm allowing this Encyclopedia Brown business is because I don't want any more hurt kids. You two are included in that. So, Jamie, I need you to keep an eye out for her. I've heard you're a brawler. I'm okay with that.
Do you honestly think I can't take care of myself? Holmes asked, draped over the love seat like a boneless cat. I'll have you know I'm an expert at single stick and baritsu.
Yes, and sometimes a pair of fists is much more useful, I said, if less dramatic.
I'll keep an eye out, detective. Will you clear us publicly?
Terrible idea, Holmes put in.
It might lead to escalation on the murderer's part if they think they need to reconvince the police of our guilt. No, tell the school privately, but don't let anyone release a statement.
Fine. More crackling. I'll send over what we have so far on the snake.
And a copy of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, I said.
Fine. You should know that we found the ski mask the intruder used in a garbage can outside Stevenson Hall, but we weren't able to lift any prints off it.
These people are too good for that, Holmes said.
I coughed.
But yes, send over the bit about the snake, and I want access to the personnel files of all of Sherringford's students and employees, including any EU immigration information.
I'd lose my job.
You'd lose your job anyway when they find out you're letting us help.
Static.
Done, he said finally. Charlotte, Jamie, just keep your mouth shut.
Yes, yes, Holmes said. Thank you, and hung up on him.
It was Monday at lunch. I'd hidden away in Holmes's lab in an attempt to finish writing my poem for Mr. Wheatley's class that afternoon. It was already going badly, but then I watched Holmes finish her calculus problem set in the 10 minutes between concluding some frothy, smelly experiment and picking up her violin for a spin through Beethoven's Kreutzer Sonata as if it were Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. She threw her bow down.
I have to wait until the school day is over to investigate. 2 hours, she said. Do you think if I set fire to the maths building...
No.
But...
Still no.
Why don't you help me with this poem, I asked, an attempt to derail her. It needs to be one that's difficult for me to write, whatever that means.
What do you have so far, she asked.
The... Or maybe A. I'm not sure.
I'm bad with words, she sat down next to me. Too imprecise, too many shades of meaning, and people use them to lie. Have you ever heard someone lie to you on the violin? Well, I suppose it can be done, but it would take far more skill.
Speaking of lying, I said, who played your masked man the other night? One of Lena's on-and-off hookups. I knew I needed a failsafe, and Lena was willing to play along. We'd laid the groundwork up a week ago. All she needed was the go-ahead. She'd been telling him she loved scary movies, and being afraid sort of turned her on, and asking him if he had a ski mask, that sort of thing. All she had to do was mention that I'd be away on Sunday night. He didn't question it at all when she screamed and chased him out, and after, I had her put a fresh mask I'd taken from the athletics shed into the bin outside. Really, it's a good thing she's so completely insane. It means she can get away with anything.
And how is she holding up after her scare?
I'm fine, she said airily. I think she's counting the days until her new handbag comes in the post.
I put my pen down.
I thought you might pay her off. With what money?
She bit her lip.
She wouldn't take any, which, to be honest, makes me nervous.
The fact that she likes you enough to help you for free, that makes you nervous?
I'd rather deal in quantifiable transactions, she said. But she said she'd made a killing at poker and reminded me that her allowance is staggering. After that, she sat me down in front of her laptop and made me help her pick out something called a minaudière. Looks like a bejeweled toad.
Oh, I said, wondering what it meant that Holmes had never once offered to pay me.
I have a rainy day fund, you know, she said, not quite looking at me. Until recently, it was raining rather a lot, but I've been trying to use an umbrella.
See, and you say you're bad with words. I'm stealing that. I scrawled it down.
She drifted over to her bookshelf and lit a cigarette. With the toe of her shoe, she tapped her copy of The Casebook of Sherlock Holmes before she leaned down to pick it up. I could tell I'd lost her to her thoughts. It seemed as good a time as any to do the thing I'd been avoiding. The hospital corridors were empty when I arrived, carrying a bunch of flowers. It wasn't hard to find the right ward. They had it guarded like Fort Knox. Thankfully, Detective Shepherd had had the wherewithal to put my name on the visitor list, and after showing my ID to two separate policemen, I was allowed into her room. I'd been told that she was awake, but her eyes were closed when I came in. She looked terrible. Her blonde hair was matted to her head with sweat, her arms wound in tubes and tape. Strangely enough, she was clutching a whiteboard to her chest in the way you would a teddy bear. As quietly as I could, I put the flowers on the table beside her bed and debated writing her a note. Was that what the board was for? While I stood there, Elizabeth opened one eye, then the other. "Hi," I said. "I hope you don't mind that I came." She shook her head no, though I wasn't sure if it was, "No, I don't mind," or, "No, actually, leave." "May I sit down?" A nod. "How long until you get your voice back?" I asked. When Detective Shepherd said that Elizabeth had been unable to speak to the police, I hadn't thought he meant it literally. Slowly, achingly, she pulled a marker out from the folds of her blanket and scrawled something down on the board. I peered over at what she was writing. "Don't know," it said. I didn't mean to interrogate her. That wasn't why I'd come. Besides, Shepherd had told us that Elizabeth's parents had asked the police for a few days' grace for their daughter. They said that she had been through enough without being forced to relive it all. "I'm sorry," I told Elizabeth, looking down at my hands. I'd come to apologize. It was why I hadn't brought Holmes. Apologizing was the kind of thing that made her break out in hives. A scribbling sound.
"For what?"
"For what happened to you. You didn't deserve this. Any of it. I'm sorry."
"I don't remember all of it, but the detective told me you found me and got help. Thank you."
Her exhausted eyes met mine, exhausted and gentle. I didn't deserve that gentleness.
"I hope you feel better soon," I said, standing to leave, scribbling again.
"Detective said blue carbuncle to my parents. He thought I was asleep. Explanation?" I sat back down.
"Do you know the story?"
A head shake. She scrubbed her board blank with her hospital gown and wrote, "Talk fast. My parents went to get takeout. They won't tell me anything, but I need to know." She furiously underlined the last four words.
I understood what it was like, being kept in the dark. "It's a Sherlock Holmes story," I began, "about a rare missing diamond, a blue carbuncle. One that a policeman finds in the throat of a dead Christmas goose on the street. Holmes and Watson trace the goose back to its breeder and from there to the breeder's brother. He'd stolen the gem from a countess and hidden it in a goose's craw." It was the quick and dirty version, the boring one, all facts, no flair. It left out all the details that made the story something I loved. But Sherlock Holmes's strategies and Dr. Watson's observations didn't have a place in this guarded hospital room. Even so, Elizabeth listened avidly. When I'd finished, she held up her whiteboard. "So I guess I'm the goose." I hesitated, and she lifted her eyebrows in a challenge. "Guess so," I said. "Fucked up." "Yeah, it was. Impossibly so." "How much do you remember about that night?" "Not much. Seeing you, making out with Randall. They showed me the thing that was in my throat."
"Did you recognize it?"
"No." Her eyes were imploring. "Do you know anything about it?"
"The police are trying to solve this as fast as they can." I took a deep breath.
"Did Randall do this to you? Do you remember?" She shook her head, blushing a little. "I don't remember his face, but I do remember what the guy said. Give my regards to Charlotte Holmes. I don't think Randall would say that."
There was a commotion outside the door.
"Who did you let in to see my daughter? A friend? What's his name?"
I didn't hear the police officer's reply. Hastily, Elizabeth rubbed her board clean and then started writing something else. Elizabeth's mother barged into the room, her arms full of Chinese food.
"Don't tell me," she said in a dangerous voice. "You're Jamie Watson. You're the one that found her."
She might have said found her, but it was clear what she meant was attacked her. Elizabeth's eye seized on mine.
"No," I said, extending a hand. "I'm Gary. Gary Snyder."
He was a poet we were reading in Mr. Wheatley's class, one I vigorously hated.
"And what exactly are you doing here, Gary Snyder?"
Elizabeth tugged on her mother's sleeve. She held up her whiteboard, a half-completed tic-tac-toe game. Charlotte Holmes would have been proud. Her mother deflated.
"We've just been so worried, sweetie," she said,
and burst into tears over her daughter's bed. I took that as my cue to leave. "I think I have some leads," I texted Holmes in the elevator. Somehow, I wasn't surprised to find Detective Shepard waiting for me on the sofa in Sciences 442.
"So, next time, tell me when you're planning on pulling something," I said, hanging up my jacket.
Her parents were conveniently gone. Oh, Elizabeth couldn't talk to the detective, but she could easily talk to me. What, did you wait until I stepped out the door and then had the hospital cafeteria closed? The last was directed at Holmes. Across the room, she poked at her vulture skeleton until it spun in circles.
"For the record, I merely waited until you left and then had Emperor Kitchen offer free takeout to all the families in the ICU. I'll make Milo pay for it.
I told you he'd go either today or tomorrow," she said to Shepard.
"You should trust me more often, you know. I am the world's foremost Jamie Watson scholar. Look, I'm happy to question her, but next time I want to be in the loop. Otherwise I'm just going to build my own chessboard and let you move me around it."
"Stop being dramatic and tell us what happened," Shepard said, sounding like he wanted to get out of 442 as quickly as possible. I couldn't blame him. Holmes had lit up her jar of teeth from behind, probably in anticipation of the detective's visit. It was, I thought, her version of hanging fairy lights. I filled them in. Shepard made a low, growling noise. "Give my regards to Charlotte Holmes," he repeated, shaking his head. "I need to talk to John Smith again. He won't confess to the attack, only to dealing drugs, and then he only gives me information he wants me to use against you, Charlotte." Holmes touched a finger to the skeleton's nose, stilling it in its orbit.
"Something else is going to happen if our attacker doesn't get what he wants," she said. Someone else is going to get hurt.
What does he want? I said. Us locked up, no key. I don't see how he's going to get that, unless Shepard puts us away for show.
No, she frowned. I need unfettered access to the campus, not to be rotting away in some cell. We need to figure out the connection between the man you're holding and the man he claims he is. I need to make a plan.
We need to make a plan, Shepard said. So we did.
Holmes and I began by retracing our steps through the access tunnels, back to the police-cordoned storage room. John Smith's footprints still ended at its door, a literal dead end, but Holmes refused to give up. We covered what felt like miles of territory that night, her coursing ahead, me yawning clandestinely behind my hand. When we returned to her lab, we stayed up even later examining the school library's copy of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. It was a brand new school edition of the stories. The bookmark the killer had placed inside was one of the Sherringford ones they left on the circulation desk, and it was clean of all but the school librarian's fingerprints. But that was to be expected. Besides, Mr. Jones had no conceivable connection to either me or Holmes. The book itself was completely unremarkable. Intact spine, intact pages. The only remarkable thing about it was that the killer had tucked it into Dobson's cold hands. At dawn, when Holmes began going through it page by page with an actual magnifying glass, I curled up on the floor to go to sleep. I spent the next few nights even more tired, wading through all the BBC America footage that had been shot after Dobson's murder and put online. The police had requested everything that wasn't on their website, and there were hours and hours to contend with. I ran through it all frame by frame, looking for a still shot of the dealer's face. I needed to know if the man Shepard had in custody was the same one I'd seen around Sherringford. It took hours. I found a lot of talking head speculation about boarding school life, about how privileged kids consider murder to be just another game. I found a number of interviews where our classmates slagged off Holmes, slagged off me, cried for show. I ate a lot of jalapeno-flavored cheese puffs, and I didn't see a single hair of the man we were looking for. After I slept through my French class 3 days in a row, Monsieur Can cheerfully suggested that I would perhaps prefer to take Spanish, n'est-ce pas? And I decided to give the solo research up as pointless. While I'd been chained to my laptop, Holmes had done the legwork, pulling up security footage closer to home. Sherringford didn't have any cameras of their own, so she'd done a circuit of the businesses whose storefronts faced campus, getting the lowdown on their security systems. Then, she told me, it was just the simple expedient of hacking into their feeds, using this particular spring code that her brother had taught her, which, of course, she had modified herself using the blah-blah differential and then something else that sounded like conversational calculus, and my eyes began to cross. She poked my shoulder with her shoe, and I trapped it neatly with my hands. "What?" I asked. "Since you don't care about the more complex workings of tonight," she shook her foot free. "Do you want to be in charge of the snacks?"
"Snacks are complex," I said. "How do you feel about tasty, tasty puffed corn?" More footage. More cheese doodles eaten in the dark of Sciences 442. One more long, dreary, wasted weekend. Still no sign of the man we were looking for. Could he make himself go invisible? Did he even exist at all? I fell asleep with my head on a bag of Jiffy Pop and woke up nauseous and pissed off to the dim light of the screen against Holmes's face. My watch read 2:21 in the morning, but her eyes were still wide open. There was nothing else to do but ask Shepard to let me talk to his prisoner. I was sure that I'd remember his reedy, obnoxious voice, even if I couldn't exactly place his face. Shepard dragged his heels on it for days, but when it became clear that neither he nor we were making progress, he agreed to let one of us in to see him. Holmes, tight-lipped, agreed that it should be me. I'd had the clearer look at him, after all. The night before I was to go to the jail, the prisoner hung himself. It took another 3 days before we persuaded Shepard to let us into the morgue. "You're part of the forensics club,"
the medical examiner said doubtfully. I shifted my weight from foot to foot. Detective Shepherd is our advisor, I said. It was true, sort of. You could look at this semester as the weirdest independent study anyone had ever had.
I thought forensics was the school speech team. She blinked at us through her glasses. Not the science club.
Huh, I haven't heard that, I said, straight-faced. Though it was a Saturday, Holmes was wearing her school uniform, her ribbon tie pressed and perfect. She'd found a pair of glasses somewhere, black-framed ones that dwarfed her features, and she'd drawn on her eyebrows to make them seem thicker. Holmes usually looked like a weapon. Today she looked like a teen movie's idea of a dork, the one that could take off her glasses, shake out her hair, and instantly be elected prom queen. She looked, in short, like the kind of girl that adults found themselves confiding in.
"Can I tell you the truth?" she asked the examiner in an American accent. She sounded eager, bright. "I mostly wanted to come here because I heard you had an amazing microscope. I have some samples from my bio class in my bag. Could I take a look at them? I'm working on a project for the National Intel Contest, cancer research."
The examiner's face softened slightly.
"That's fine," she said and laughed self-consciously. "For a second, I thought that you wanted to look at a body."
Holmes laughed too, her pretty girl laugh.
"Oh my God, I don't know if I could handle that. How do you even get used to it? You must be so brave."
"Practice," the examiner said. It was clear that she didn't get this kind of glowing admiration every day.
"Practice and patience. Are they scary? Do you still feel like they're people, or does it change for you depending on the body?"
Holmes shook her head.
"Wow, thinking about this would keep me up at night."
The examiner pursed her lips philosophically.
"It should. These are important questions you're asking, Charlotte. I think about them every day."
I nodded to hide the fact that I thought she was full of shit. As always, Holmes was better at this than I was.
"Wow," she said. "Just wow. And it's like you run this whole place by yourself. That's awesome. How many do you end up dissecting in a day?"
"It depends, really. I only have one intact body right now." The examiner walked over to the wall of morgue drawers.
"Are you feeling brave?"
"Game, set, match." Holmes looked over at me with wide eyes.
"Oh my God," she said,
a perfect imitation of the bright, well-adjusted girl she'd never been.
"Maybe. Yes. Okay, yes, I am."
We put on gloves and masks, and the examiner put on her best fortune-teller voice, saying, "John Smith," as she pulled the drawer out of the wall with a flourish. I won't describe his face. It's enough to say that his death by hanging left him bloated and bruised and unrecognizable, far past the point where I could positively identify him. But his height was about right, his shoulders. I stared for a moment at his throat, wishing that I could hear his voice to be sure.
"Can I?"
Holmes asked, reaching for the corpse's forearm. A small line appeared between the examiner's brows.
"I guess," she said.
Swiftly, Holmes turned it over. The man had a tattoo near his wrist in the shape of a compass, underneath the word Navigator. Holmes looked at me.
"Do you remember this?"
her eyes were asking. I shook my head no and said aloud, "That's the kind of tattoo you could hide under long sleeves." At the examiner's sharp look, I coughed. I've been thinking of getting one."
"The Navigator," Holmes said to herself, lifting his arm to examine his fingernails.
She checked his fingers one at a time, lifted his chin to look at the veins of his neck. Then she ducked her head to look up the man's nostrils.
"Moriarty means seaworthy."
The examiner stared at us furiously.
"Etymology," I said. "It's really popular with the kids."
Our grace period was up, and Holmes knew it too.
"Manual labor," Holmes said, quickly deducing.
She pulled out a folded sheet of paper and an ink pad and took down the man's prints while the examiner sputtered.
Look at those finger calluses. Look at the state of his ankles. He's all muscle, but it isn't from the gym. These are a working man's muscles. Do you see the rope burn on his arm?
He's not a dealer, I said. It's not him.
It's not him, Holmes said, in the voice that was ragged and wild in hers. Jamie, it's a Moriarty.
Get out! The examiner jerked her head toward the door.
Now!
On Monday, I'd skipped all my classes. My grades were falling, lower now than they'd ever been, to be alone, to make my half-idea into a project without her peering over my shoulder. I pulled from the resources Shepard had given us access to and from the files we'd put together on our own. Flight passenger lists, family trees, Moriartys with criminal records and lists of their known aliases. I took down the riding crops from the wall and pinned all of this up in their place, then began the long and arduous task of cross-referencing. I needed to know which of the Moriartys had come into this country and when. If John Smith wasn't a member of the family, he was definitely on their payroll. The trick was to find out who hired him. In the back of my mind, I knew there was a good chance that I was blowing all of this out of proportion. The simplest answer was almost always the right one, and the idea that the entire Moriarty family was out to get me and Holmes was a big, complicated leap from where I was standing. Even if there had been a conflict between Holmes and that family, it was probably small and contained, nothing like the sprawling conspiracy that I was charting up on the wall. But I kept thinking how the Sherrinford killer was insistently recreating the Sherlock Holmes stories. Those past wrongs that Sherlock and Dr. Watson had made right were being pushed into our present, and the details of the good deeds they'd done were being used to hurt us and the people we knew. Sure, maybe the killer had a personal vendetta against Holmes, but it felt to me like it was something bigger than that, something older, something reaching back more than a century. Anyway, I couldn't ignore the way the word Moriarty made my skin crawl. I focused on four of them, the four Moriartys whose whereabouts weren't dictated by respectable jobs, who'd been sloppy enough to have their shadier dealings dragged into the public eye. Whoever was doing this to us was sloppy. There wasn't any doubt of that, and I meant to use it to my advantage. Hadrian and Philippa were a brother and sister pair of art collectors whose fortune, rumor had it, was used to buy favors from dictators in countries they wanted to plunder. Lucian was August's older brother, an advisor for some of the more scandal-ridden members of the British Parliament. I read a profile of him in The Guardian that had hinted strongly that Lucian Moriarty knew how to throw his money around to clear just about anyone's name. And then there was Lucian's younger brother, August. For this, I didn't have to look through Shepard's records. It was as easy as plugging August's name into Google and clicking a button. The first article that came up was from his college at Oxford. August had presented some complicated theorem at an academic conference in Dusseldorf. The reporter took special care to mention his age. He'd been doing his doctorate in pure math at 20. He must have been a genius to be doing that work so young. The article described his dissertation, fractals, imaginary numbers, in layman's terms, and I still couldn't begin to understand it. But it was dated 2 years back. I needed newer information to know if he was still at Oxford, if he'd graduated or been hit by a car or moved to, I don't know, Connecticut. The rest of the search results linked to academic journals and fellowship competitions all dated that same year. Not a word about his personal life or about him dating Charlotte Holmes. Just a list of his achievements. August, recipient of a prestigious Institut Zahlen grant. August, publishing on vector spaces and the cosmos in Mathematics Today. August, flown to the Arctic Circle to collaborate with scientists studying something called ice fractals. After that, there was nothing. Not a word had been written about August Moriarty in the last 2 years. I put it all up on the wall anyway. At 3 o'clock precisely, Holmes swung open the door to 442, humming something under her breath. "Hello, Watson," she said before she'd even seen me. "You're here early." And then she stopped in her tracks, staring at the wall. I realized, too late, that I'd pretty much recreated the murder den we'd found in the access tunnels. "Oh," she said. I waited for the explosion. She sighed, dropping her backpack on the floor. "It's a place to start. I came to tell you that Milo ran down John Smith's prints in some of the more unusual databases. He's worked as a domestic for the last 5 years." "A domestic?" "A servant, Watson. He was Philippa Moriarty's driver until his disappearance 4 months ago. There's our link to the family sorted. The question is if he was doing all this alone, or..." "You don't think he was. So, Philippa then?" We looked at the wall, side by side. "Have you ever heard of a rat king?" She reached out and touched the corner of Hadrian's photo. "The Moriartys, their disgusting tales are all tied together. Let's not try to separate them just yet. We'll start by finding out which of them came into this country and when." On her direction, ship manifests went up onto the wall, freighters that had traveled from England to Boston, and the names of the sailors who manned them. "Seaworthy," she muttered, taping them up. We went through lists of private airstrips and private jets, helicopters, rowboats. We scrolled through records in New England and in England both. Moriarty was a horrifyingly common last name, but things became even worse when we began running known aliases. Our series of papers grew day by day until they engulfed the wall. Philippa spoke at a gallery opening in Glasgow. Lucian was photographed with the British Prime Minister. Hadrian showed up on some German talk show to chat about the Sphinx. How could it be any of them? Were they taking care of business in Europe, flying by night to Connecticut to ruin our lives? It seemed absurd, even by our standards. I spent every moment in 442 working like a madman. I was even growing the beginnings of a madman's scratchy beard, which I secretly thought was kind of awesome. And she worked right beside me with a fury I hadn't yet seen. Almost everything else went out the window. Especially for Holmes. She'd stopped battling me on August Moriarty. Every time I tried to learn something, anything about what happened between them, she regarded me with a weary tilt of her head, like I was a fly she couldn't quite get rid of. I was relatively sure she wasn't eating or sleeping, but it wasn't just her attitude. Her eyes were somehow both glassy and dry, and as she scratched absently at her scalp, going over her millionth passenger manifest, her hair made a crackling sound that hair really shouldn't make. I kept stifling the urge to ask her if she was okay, to touch her forehead to see if she had a fever, to take care of her. I brought her food, but it stayed untouched on the plate, no matter how I tried to cajole her into eating. When I caught her taking 20 minutes to eat a single almond, I began wondering if there was some kind of Watsonian guide for the care and keeping of Holmeses. When I sent my father an email to that effect, subject line, "I need your help," postscript, "still haven't forgiven you and won't," he responded that, yes, over the years he'd written down an informal series of suggestions in his journal. He'd do his best to adapt and type them up for me. When the list arrived the next day, it was 12 pages long, single-spaced. The suggestions ran from the obvious. 8. On the whole, coaxing works rather better than straightforward demands. To the irrelevant, 39. Under all circumstances, do not allow Holmes to cook your dinner unless you have a taste for cold, unseasoned broth. To the absurd, 87. Hide all firearms before throwing Holmes a surprise birthday party. 2. Finally, the useful. 1. Search often for opiates and dispose of as needed. Retaliation will not come often, though is swift and exacting when it does. Do not grow attached to one's mirrors or drinking glasses. 2. During your search, always begin with the hollowed-out heels of Holmes's boots. 102. Have no compunctions about drugging Holmes's tea if he hasn't slept. 41. Be prepared to receive compliments once every 2 to 3 years. 74. Underlined twice. Whatever happens, remember it is not your fault and likely could not have been prevented, no matter your efforts. I wondered if I should create some kind of sub-clause for when the Holmes in question was a girl and her Watson was a guy who liked girls. It's not your fault if you care too much about her, if you want impossible things. It couldn't have been prevented, no matter your efforts. I had to employ rule number 9. Sometimes, for your own sake, you must leave Holmes to his own devices, even if you return to find he's set himself on fire. When real life began to creep in. The rugby team had asked for permission for me to rejoin in what should have been the last week of my suspension, and gotten it from the school. Holmes had insisted that I go. A number of Dobson's friends were on the squad, and she'd decided I should ask them in a roundabout manner about his last weeks alive. If he was seeing anyone unusual, leaving campus at late hours, taking strange calls. If some blonde man had sold him any drugs and what he'd said. That sort of thing. I'd figured that I could manage well enough. Holmes disagreed. "You're a terrible liar," she said, perched on her lab table. I stood before her, like a schoolboy about to recite his lessons. "More specifically, I can read your thoughts as if they were printed in block letters on your forehead. Really, sometimes you think so loudly that I can hear you in the next room. There's no way you can approach your teammates in an innocent manner. We need to fix that." "I'm so sorry to hear about your unfortunate telepathy," I snapped. "See, just there? You're frustrated and think I'm being rude." "Oh, well done," I told her. "Really fine detective work. Why are we doing this now?" She ran a hand through her hair. "Watson," she said, "we've hit a brick wall. We've come up with nothing new. Just let's get you into shape, okay?" "Okay," I deflated at the pleading note in her voice. She smiled. "Let's start with the basics. How to recognize when others are lying to you, so you can begin to police your own habits." She walked me through it, where someone looks when they're recalling a memory and when they're fabricating one. How an honest man stands and a lying one. How they hold their shoulders, slumped, their hands behind their back to hide fidgeting. If they prefer to stand or sit, to stand probably with nervous feet. All of it she rattled off as though reading from a book. "How young did you learn all this?"
5, she said. "My mum was cross with Milo for teasing me. He kept telling me Santa Claus was real."
"I'm sorry," I asked.
"Was?
Don't you mean wasn't?"
"No."
She ran her finger down the agenda in her lap and sighed.
"Right, so it's 8 o'clock already, and you're tetchy because you have history homework for tomorrow. I can tell by your feet. Stop shuffling. So do a practice run or two, and then we'll be finished."
I stuffed my hands in my pockets to keep myself from fidgeting. "Do you want me to try to lie to you?" At that, I watched Holmes fight back a laugh.
"God, no. That would be pointless. No, I'll make a series of statements, and you can tell me which are true. Thumb up for truth, thumb down for a lie."
"I'm pretty good at reading you, you know," I told her.
"That might be true," she said gamely. "But did you know that my father worked for the MOD for 14 years before the Kremlin got wind of a scheme of his and tried to have him assassinated? Or that growing up, I had a cat called Mouse. She's white and black and very fussy, and once the neighbor boy tried to drown her in a bucket. My mother hates her. Milo joined up with MI5 at age 17. No, that's false. Milo runs the world's largest private security company. Or no, actually, he's an enfant terrible preparing a hostile takeover of Google. He's unemployed. He's a complete tosser. For years, he was my favorite person in the world."
I held my hand out rather stupidly between us. My thumb hadn't moved. I'd spent too much time imagining what her life was like before me, so I drank in all these facts, even the contrary ones, as if they were water.
"Pay attention to my face, Watson, not my words. Listen to my tone. How am I sitting? Where am I looking?"
She snapped her fingers.
I own 3 dressing gowns. I dislike guns. They cheapen confrontations. I first took cocaine at age 12, and sometimes I take oxycodone when I'm miserable. When I met you, my initial thought was that my parents had set it up. No, it was that you were dreamy.
Grinning, I put my thumb up. She pushed it back down.
No, I thought, finally, what someone wants from me, I can give them. I know how to play to an audience. I liked you. I thought you were another chauvinistic bastard who thought I couldn't take care of myself.
All true, I said quietly before she could continue. All of it, at one point or another, including the business about your brother. He's done all those things, been all those things. You've thought all those things about me.
Explain your method. Holmes pulled the cigarette out of her pocket and lit it.
Because somewhere in that brain of yours, you've decided I should know more about you, but you don't want to do it outright. No, it can't be simple. You're Charlotte Holmes. You have to do it sideways, and this is the most sideways approach you could dream up.
She exhaled in a long stream, head tipped to the side. I suppressed a cough.
Fine, she said finally, and I chanced a smile. Grudgingly, she returned it.
But none of those deductions were methodical, Watson. That was all psychology. I loathe psychology.
It's okay, I told her. I hate losing at games, too. The next day, she put me through another session, this time with a new test subject. I shouldn't have been surprised that she brought in Lena. We met on the quad after classes, shivering and stomping our boots. Lena's hair hung in a braid down her back, and her hat had a knit flower that drooped down over her brow. She had a date with Tom in town that night, she told us, so she couldn't stay too late. It was odd to watch her next to Holmes in her trim black coat, hands stuffed into the fur muff strung from her neck. When the wind nipped at us, Lena huddled against her roommate with a familiarity that was almost shocking. I wondered what they talked about together. I couldn't imagine it. For 2 hours, until the tips of my fingers were literally blue from the cold, I practiced reading Lena's tells. In the process, I learned her down to the ground. I really didn't need to know that much about her sex life. By the end of it, I was so exhausted from shivering that I wanted nothing more than to go to bed with a cup of something warm. Thankfully, when I went a full 10 minutes without mislabeling one of Lena's statements, Holmes let us call it a day. We ducked into the Stevenson Hall lobby for warmth.
You guys are up to secret things, I can tell. How are your secret things? Lena asked, unwinding the scarf from her neck.
They're about to go much better, Holmes discreetly stuffed a roll of bills into Lena's coat pocket.
Run the poker game as usual tomorrow, will you? I don't want anyone to note a change in my behavior.
Lena pulled the money back out and pressed it into Holmes's hand.
Keep it, she said. I kind of like being your test subject.
Holmes froze.
But, don't be weird about it. We're friends, and I don't, need the money.
Standing on her tiptoes, she kissed me on the cheek.
Thanks, Jamie. That was a lot of fun, but I want to get to ask you inappropriate questions. Maybe we could have pizza in town sometime.
You're having pizza in town with Tom tonight, Holmes said.
Sure, I said, ignoring her. I'd like that.
Holmes had on the kind of scowl toddlers get when their favorite toy is stolen away.
We're done here, she announced, and dragged me off by my elbow.
When I arrived at practice the next day, Klein was surveying the rugby pitch, fists on hips like a taller, dumber Napoleon. He was mad and not without cause. Their record stood so far at a predictable 0-7.
We're starting in 10. Look alive, he shouted.
It was true, the team did seem dead. Our fly half was actually sleeping on his side at midfield. Larson, our 8-man, trotted by and kicked him in the small of the back. Without a flicker of interest, Coach Q looked up from his director's chair and then back down at his copy of men's health.
We're down to 14 players. So many students have gone home. I don't think the school would have let you back on if that wasn't the case.
Klein looked me over.
So, have you been staying in shape?
Running 5 miles every day, I lied.
But I'll do whatever. I'm happy to be back on the team.
Another lie delivered smoothly. I'd been practicing.
Where's Randall? I haven't talked to him since Elizabeth, you know, and I wanted to make sure we were on decent terms.
Klein pointed.
He's getting ready to drill with the Bax. If you want to talk to him, make it quick.
He cupped his hands around his mouth.
We're starting in 5.
When I caught up with him, Randall was even redder-faced than usual. I wasn't sure if it was from exertion or anger.
"Oh, hey, the jackass is back," he said, shoving past me on his way to the bench.
"A bit of both, then."
"Randall, wait."
He slowed down slightly and I pulled up even.
"Look, I wanted to say I'm sorry about Dobson. I didn't know him that well, but I know he was your friend."
"You have some issues, dude. That was fucked up. Going after him for saying what's on his mind. He was just messing, and you jumped on him. Then he shows up dead. Fucked up,"
he repeated and dug his water bottle out from his bag.
I counted backward from 5.
"Charlotte Holmes is like my sister, okay? He said the absolute worst thing he could have said. But I didn't kill him. I promise that."
"Then why do the police keep hauling you in? Why were you the one who found Elizabeth?"
"Wrong place, wrong time," I said.
"Bullshit," he countered.
"I've seen that detective with you like a million times. You got hauled down to the station after Lizzie got hurt. Why does he suspect you if you're so innocent?"
"Same reason why you would if you were them."
The words came out bitterly. That fear of winding up in an orange jumpsuit hadn't entirely gone away. A bit of it lingered at the edges of everything I did, really. I pulled from the truth of that feeling, laid it under my words.
Randall eyed me.
"I don't know, man."
"Think what you want," I told him. "But you should know I feel like shit about all of it. I've heard all these rumors that Dobson hung himself, and I can't sleep, thinking I somehow drove him to it."
A lie, of course, but I was baiting my trap. Holmes taught me that. People would much rather correct you than answer a straightforward question. Randall wasn't an exception to the rule.
"Dude, you weren't that important to him," he said.
"No, I heard that he was poisoned. I don't know which one's true."
"Poisoned? From the dining hall food?"
"Maybe," Randall shrugged. "But other people would probably be sick then, too. I don't know. He'd been eating these cookies his sister sent him, and they looked nasty. Maybe it was in those. Or that weird protein powder he had. That stuff was the wrong color. He said it was from Germany and expensive, but I didn't buy it. Maybe your little friend slipped something into it."
"Out on the pitch," Klein hollered.
"All right," Randall said.
"Later."
The venom was gone from his voice. I was happy about that, at least.
"You good?" Klein asked.
"Yeah," I said.
"Hey, so he said something about protein powder. Do you know a good brand?"
I bent to lace a cleat so he couldn't see my face. I wasn't sure I could pull that one off. I wore cable-knit jumpers and read Vonnegut novels and had a girl for a best friend. I was about as likely to build up giant biceps as to build a colony on the moon.
"Talk to Nurse Bryony at the infirmary," he said. "She has some prescription stuff she gets from Europe."
I reached in my bag, ostensibly for my water bottle, and sent Holmes an urgent text. I just hoped her phone was on this time and not pickled in formaldehyde or in pieces across her chemistry table. Practice crawled by at a snail's pace, especially once we began running plays. When Klein announced the last of them, I gritted my teeth and waited for my opportunity. Then I threw myself up for a catch in the most insane possible position, sprawling out like a diver going into water. I let myself go limp. My head bounced once, twice, 3 times against the frozen ground. No one could say I wasn't dedicated to my game. I heard Klein holler,
"That's it! Watson! Watson!"
and the rest of the team roaring. Things went black. When I woke, I found myself blinking up into fluorescent lights. Holmes's tear-streaked face was hovering over mine.
She seemed genuinely upset, and for a second, I thought there'd been another murder. I struggled to sit up on my elbows.
"Oh, baby,"
she sniffed, shoving me back down on the bed with a touch more force than was necessary.